Really good to see you. Thank you for being here. We're saying this every week now. It's so good to see everybody, perhaps more than ever at this moment in time. And thank you to everybody on Zoom. We're so glad you're here with us. We hope you feel very much a part of what's going on today as well. And we want to feel a part of you and what you're doing there on Zoom. So thank you, everyone. My name's Matthew. I'm the lead pastor here. Just wanted to say, you know, we had to cancel or postpone our pumpkin patch movie night event last night. That was very disappointing. I was tracking the weather forecast because we've had such amazing fall weather. Like, it's beautiful out there now, right? And there was one window where it was raining, and it happened to be that time when we organized that event. So don't know what to make of all that, but it was disappointing. But I think it was the right call. We were here at 5 o'clock when the event was going to be beginning, and it was still pouring with rain. It would have been a miserable evening. So we've postponed though until after the service today. So please come and join us. We've got plenty of pumpkins to carve and paint. There'll be free pizza. We've got popcorn and hot cider. Everybody's welcome, whether you're planning on doing that or not. Please do stay on afterwards. And if you're on Zoom, it's an outdoor event. We're prioritizing safety. So if you want to just come on, there'll be a window from the end of the service to the beginning of the event. So come on over and join us. Everybody is really welcome. We're expecting we'll have some people from our local community as well. We put up signs to explain that it's postponed. So we're going to do it, whatever, and it's going to be a good time together. Today, we're going to wrap up our series called When Everything Seems Broken. Last week, we looked at the life of Jacob, a sort of heroic figure in the Hebrew Bible, and looked at his story and under the motif of wounded healers. And today, we're going to, it's sort of part two, if you like, we're going to look at another person's life. That's the life of Moses. Moses was perhaps, or is perhaps, the preeminent figure in Judaism. If you look back through the history of the Hebrew people, and certainly the evolution of the Jewish religion, Moses is probably the most prominent person. And so, viewed, I think, as an incredible man, an incredible human being. But as we're going to explore today, he was actually a frail human being. It took him a while to work out that his weakness wasn't necessarily a liability. And we're going to explore this theme of power through weakness, which I think can sometimes feel a bit of a cliche, right? You know, none of us really want to feel weak. And we feel anything but empowered often when we're weak. But we're just going to explore that a little bit this morning and look at the life of Moses. So we're going to start off with a reading. Rachel's going to come read us. We're going to just look at the early part of Moses' life, make a few comments about that, and then start applying it into our own lives. So thank you, Rachel.
Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, when you're helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it's a girl, let her live. The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live? The midwives answered Pharaoh, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They're vigorous. They give birth before the midwives arrive. So God was kind to the midwives. And people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. Every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live.
Okay, thank you, Rachel. So this is a pretty dark story, a story that probably many of us are familiar with. You know, the story of Moses is kind of, you know, been made into movies. We saw a clip from a famous movie at the beginning of the service today. You know, we're familiar with it, but, you know, perhaps we can get beyond that familiarity and recognize this is a dark story. This is a story about a tyrant, Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, who is oppressing a people, the people of Israel, who were living within his land, Egypt. And, you know, we left Jacob last week in Egypt. He'd taken his family to Egypt to be with his brother Joseph because there was a famine, and they stayed in Egypt and multiplied. They were successful. They were doing well as a mini nation within a nation. But Pharaoh is afraid. Pharaoh's jealous. Pharaoh feels very insecure, and there's reasons for that. If you look at some of the history of ancient Egypt, there were other nations that occupied the country and caused, you know, some problems to the Egyptians, and different parties within Egypt that sort of colluded with the enemy. So he's afraid that the Israelites are going to increase in number and maybe pose a threat to his stability, to his country's stability. So Pharaoh reacts to that insecurity with violence and hatred. And oppresses the people abysmally. On the other hand, we have, in this part of the story, we have the midwives. Now, we mentioned last week in the story of Joseph how frequently women are the main protagonists in the story. In this story, Pharaoh's not named. He's this anonymous, powerful king, this tyrant. But the midwives are actually named, or at least two of them are named. They become the focus of the story, and they are in resistance to the oppression of the Pharaoh, that we have civil disobedience, where they refuse to follow the orders of Pharaoh. They show great courage. And then when they're challenged, they show some kind of wiliness. You know, last week, again, we talked about how Jacob was a clever guy. Rebecca was a clever woman. They were able to work situations to their favor. And here we see that same kind of theme where the midwives, they're surreptitious and they're careful. And when they're challenged, they kind of tell a white lie, if you want to call it that, but they're doing everything they can to protect these babies because it says they fear God. They've got incredible courage because they fear God. And then Pharaoh has to, you know, he's kind of outwitted, so he resorts to even more violence, and it says that he orders them to throw the children, not just to kill them, but to throw them now into the Nile, the baby boys. And there's some foreshadowing there, because he's setting an order for the drowning of the children, and this is sort of foreboding of what's going to happen to him. He's going to drown in the Red Sea or the Sea of Reeds later on in the story. So there's some foreshadowing there. Let's just move on a little bit with the story. Rachel's going to read the next section here for us, where we hear about the birth of Moses.
Now, a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her female slave to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. So the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water."
Thanks, Rachel. It's really confusing getting up and down with masks on and masks off, isn't it? I was just doing that and thinking, oh, I've got to put it back. Okay, it reminds me of that scene in Mrs. Doubtfire where he's sort of switching between, have you seen that one? You know, You've got to see the movie, I guess. Here's the birth of Moses. Now we were looking last week at the life of Jacob and saw that there was this big prophecy about Jacob's birth. And, you know, that often happens with biblical characters. There's, an angelic greeting and predictions about this child's life. We don't get any of that here with Moses. But what we do have in the story is a lot of leading narrative that sort of insinuates things and arouses our suspicions or our hopes. And again, in this part of the narrative, we see how even in an incredibly patriarchal society, this story is moved along completely by women. First of all, there's Pharaoh's daughter who stands contrast to Pharaoh as a compassionate person. You know, we just read Pharaoh saying, throw the babies into the Nile, and Pharaoh's daughter feels sorry for the baby when she sees this baby in the basket. There's a sense of irony that she's going to rescue the very person who's going to be the nemesis of her father, or actually when it's Pharaoh's son who becomes the one that Moses actually overcomes and leads the people of Israel away from. But she's in stark contrast to Pharaoh. Then we have Moses' sister, who is what a woman. She's standing there on watch, and then she suddenly has this idea, what if I intervene and then I'm going to get Moses' real mum, my mum, to be the wet nurse, but she's really her mother. And it's just genius. She is like Rebecca in the previous stories that we've been looking at. She's even though she's in a weak position, she's using guile and tact and skill to overcome power and oppression. Then we have Moses' mother, who, think of her as a very wise person. She decides to hide Moses away. But there's some language in the narrative that alludes to something more. I mean, she's highly honored in this story. First of all, when it says she looks at Moses, it says that she sees that he's a fine boy. In the original language there, the Hebrew language, it says that she saw that he was good. And it's the same language that's used in the first creation story in the book of Genesis, where it says after creating each day, God looks at it and says it was good. So we have here Moses' mother, if you like, being compared to God, but at least being seen as this creative force. She's a creative force in this story, and she's creating something. She's given birth to something that is going to represent like a cosmic change, a major change in the narrative and the story that we're reading about here, which is Moses coming into the story, who's going to liberate the people of Israel. There's also this word that's used for the basket. It's in the Hebrew, it's teva. And it's only used in two instances in the Hebrew scriptures. One when in the story of Noah for the ark, and one for this basket that she makes to hide Moses in. So actually in the King James Version, the older translations of the English Bible, the term Ark of Bulrushes is used. So they recognize that that's the connection. So, you know, when you read it, you're reminded of the Ark, you're reminded of deliverance, you're reminded of people being saved. So it's building this story up, this sense of expectation that some kind of salvation, some kind of redemption, some kind of freedom is going to come through Moses, and all because of what his mother has done. And then we have some more foreshadowing, because it says she lays the basket in the reeds. And as we just mentioned, Pharaoh meets his demise in the Sea of Reeds later, the Red Sea. We call it the Red Sea in English, but it's really the Reed Sea, the Sea of Reeds, because it's a very shallow sea full of all kinds of reeds. So there's some clever telling of the story here to raise our expectations. And then we have Moses. And Moses is a passive character in the story, right? He's a baby. He's subject to the actions of his mother, his sister, his adoptive mother, Pharaoh's daughter. But his name there's a pun on his name, because it's an Egyptian name. That's what Pharaoh's daughter calls him, Moses. It's an Egyptian word. But it sounds like a word in Hebrew, which means to draw out. So Pharaoh's daughter says, I drew him out of the water. That's why she's calling him Moses. It's obviously, we don't expect that she speaks Hebrew. So the narrator is using this as a sort of irony. Moses in Hebrew means to draw out. And it's in the active tense. The word Moses is in the active tense. In other words, it's not one who was drawn out, which would be accurate for Moses, right? He was drawn out of the water by Pharaoh's daughter. But it means one who draws out of the water. And again, there's a sense of foreshadowing here that Moses will be the one who will draw his people through the water, as we saw in that clip at the beginning where Charlton Heston as Moses, you know, parts the waters and they walk through free across the Reed Sea. That's what Moses is going to do. He's symbolically going to draw them out of the water through into liberation from slavery. So we have in this beginning part of the narrative all these expectations set that here is a heroic figure. This figure, Moses, is going to be the deliverer of his people. He's going to lead them out. And we all know the rest of the story. So we're very much thinking that, right? Because we know what happens in the end. But as the narrative goes on, there's a sense of disappointment, because what happens is Moses is he goes back to he's raised by his biological mother and then is given over when he's older, it says in the text, to his adoptive mother, Pharaoh's daughter, and he grows up in the luxury and privilege of the Egyptian royalty. But you imagine, because he was older when he was handed over, that he had some sense of consciousness of being Hebrew. And so when he sees the subjugation of the Hebrew people, it stirs up a sense of injustice in him. It stirs up some anger in him. And he goes out one day and he sees an Egyptian oppressing an Israelite and beating them. And Moses intervenes and kills the Egyptian. His anger is aroused. He kills him and then he buries him, and you know he carries on. Interestingly, he doesn't organize anything. He's just perhaps a courageous act, but perhaps a fearful act. It's ambiguous here. What he hasn't opposed Pharaoh. He's just reacted in a particular instance, in a circumstance. He's dealing with an individual situation rather than a systemic situation. Anyway, he carries on his life in the palace, and then he sees two Israelites arguing and fighting, and he goes over to try and stop and say, "Hey, why are you guys fighting? You know, you're under oppression yourselves. You should be working together." And they accuse him of killing the Egyptian. It comes to light that it's known that he killed this other person. And Moses is afraid. Rather than trying to corral them and say, "Look, let's start some resistance, let's start some rebellion," he doesn't try to organize people. He's just immediately afraid and runs away. And he runs out into the desert. He escapes any chance of him being caught. He's clearly too afraid to take on the power of Pharaoh, and he ends up out in the desert. And he goes to a well, and there's some women at the well and some men at the well, and the male shepherds sort of push the women away because they want to get the prime watering spot. And Moses, again, with this sense of justice that he has, intervenes and protects them. And the women take him back to their father, and Moses ends up getting married to one of those women. And has a baby, and the baby is called Gershom, and Gershom means exile. And Moses is out now. All these expectations about him don't appear to have come to fruition. He's kind of a failure. He's afraid. He's run away. He doesn't seem to have any leadership ability. He's in the desert. He's managing sheep, nomadic people. He's in exile. He's a nobody now. And so we get to a point in the story where we're wondering, well, what's going to happen? I mean, all these expectations have become, you know, they're not true. We were built up to expect something that just wasn't going to happen. But then Moses has this famous experience of the burning bush. So we're going to listen to that now as the final part of this narrative.
"And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go, I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you.
Okay, so this is really the big turning point. Moses has this mystical experience where he sees this bush burning in the desert, probably not an uncommon sight. But what's uncommon is that the bush isn't being consumed. It's not just burning out, it's just continuing to burn. So he goes over to investigate, and we have this dialogue where he engages with God. It's again, another very famous part of the story. What's interesting here is that that part of the narrative begins with that God heard the cry of the people, that God is compassionate. God is on the side of the oppressed. God is on the side of the weak. That's probably not all that surprising to us. We talk about that a lot. And, you know, that's been talked about a lot over the centuries since these stories were written down. But at the time, in that setting, in that era, this was really surprising. The thought that God would be on the side of weak people, of insignificant people, was really unheard of. God was on the side of the strong. I mean, that's why they're strong. They embody a power and a force that you might even call divine. And in fact, Pharaoh in those days was viewed as divine. The pharaohs were gods, as were many other leaders in ancient cultures, whether it was the, look out to the East with Chinese and Japanese emperors, or whether it's in the West with the Roman Caesars. Very often, leaders were equated with deity. So deity is associated with power and strength and powerful people. That's why they're powerful. That's why they're successful. Why on earth would you think that God, the ultimate being in the universe, is with lowly people? Why are they so lowly then if God is with them? But here in this narrative, we're having all that turned around. God is saying, no, I'm with the midwives. I'm with Moses' mother, I'm with Moses' sister, I'm with the people who are being oppressed, I'm their God. And there's some tension there immediately, some contradiction there. God is with weak people, and we don't intuitively necessarily believe that. Secondly, we have Moses as a weak person. Moses is afraid. He's saying, like, who am I? You know, he's lost all any sense of confidence, he's afraid. He said, you know, it's interesting. I think he said in this, you know, strange dialogue he has with God, he's saying, "What if I go to them and they say, no, God didn't appear to you?" You know, he's questioning whether the people of Israel will believe him. He's not just afraid of going back and challenging Pharaoh. He's afraid that he won't be accepted by his own people. He feels that he's blown it. Why on earth would they follow me? I mean, I ran away. I'm a nobody. He grew up in a very privileged position. He was positioned, perhaps, better than anybody else in the royal court, the Pharaoh, to take action, to do something from the inside, to do something with the privilege that he had, with the power that he had. But he didn't do anything. He just ran away. So he's worried now that they're not going to take him seriously. So he feels unbelievably weak, and he's resistant to this call that where God is saying, okay, you need to go and take and challenge Pharaoh and take Pharaoh on. After this passage, there's this sort of comedic interaction where Moses sort of brings up one excuse after the other, and God kind of refutes every excuse. For instance, in the first verse of chapter 4, it says, Moses answered, what if they do not believe me or listen to me? Say, the Lord did not appear to you. In verse 10, we hear him say, Moses said to the Lord, pardon your servant, Lord. I've never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and tongue. So Moses is just making excuses after excuse because he's afraid, and he feels so weak, and he feels incapable of doing what he's being asked to do. This is the turning point in the whole story. This is the turning point in Moses' life. And I think for many of us, it represents a turning point or a potential turning point in our own lives, because we all have been in a situation like this, I think. Situations where we feel disempowered, or we feel useless, we just feel like a loser, we feel like we can't do anything. We're afraid of failing. We're perhaps afraid to even get started on anything because of the situation that we're in. And the turning point here, I want to sort of try to summarize the turning point with three things that are said in the story, in this moment of the burning bush. The first one is, who am I? Moses has this crisis of being. It's an existential crisis. He's like, who am I? He's lost his identity. He has no confidence whatsoever. Whereas previously he probably felt some kind of power, some kind of leverage because of his position in the royal court, and he rises up and kills that Egyptian. He takes some action. Now he's feeling, who the heck am I? Has anybody ever felt like that? I know I have. And then I am who I am. So Moses says, who am I? The response, the divine response is, I am who I am. Here we have the introduction of this unspeakable name of God. God is defined as being itself. When God defines God's self, when God's self discloses, it's this very mystical, huge statement of I am who I am. I am being. I am everything. I contain everything and am in everything. And then the third question, or the third statement, I am with you. God says to Moses, I will be with you. So we've got these playings on the same verb, I am, in these three different ways in that passage that we just listened to together. What I think this represents is the existential crisis of weakness that we all experience. We all have strengths that we lean on, but we all have weaknesses. We all have limitations that take us to the point of saying, who am I? What can I do? And in that context, the great I am, being itself, the God of the universe that contains the universe and is in the universe, comes to us and says, I'm with you. And there's this union with God. There's this divine union, where we experience the intimacy and closeness of the divine presence, the divine being. And it's that from which we gain strength. It's that from which we are empowered. In other words, this story, I think, shows us, and we know the rest of the story, as I said earlier. We know that Moses does stand up, go out, and liberate the people of Israel. And it's a pretty amazing story. We know that that happens, but this is the point where something changes, and it's a process. It doesn't happen instantly, but where Moses, ironically, through his weakness rather than his strength, is able to experience union with God, closeness with God. And we see that played out in the story, where he kind of is engaging with God in this incredibly intimate way throughout the rest of the story. That's why he's such a respected figure in the Hebrew tradition. He experiences that through weakness, not through his strength. And he experiences this incredible empowerment, this strength, through his weakness. Again, I think we make that statement of experiencing strength or power through weakness, it feels like a cliche. It feels like, well, yeah, it's a platitude is what you say. But is that really our experience? Can we really experience that? I think both Paul, who was one of the early Christian leaders, and Jesus himself would agree that that's possible. Paul in 2 Corinthians says, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Okay, Paul could be a masochist, But let's assume he's not. I think what he's saying is, okay, in these hardships, in these difficulties, in these things that I struggle with, and he's alluding to some dark struggle, some dark internal struggle that he's going on, that's going on in his life, and we don't know what that is exactly. But he's saying that in that context, that's when I experience Christ most. That's when I experience the divine presence most. That's where I'm truly empowered. He goes on then to say, in Philippians, another letter that he wrote, I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do all this through him who gives me strength. And one of the themes of Paul's life was, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. That anything is possible. And if you think about it, this idea of union with God, empowerment by the divine being, if we were relying on our strengths only take us so far, right? They're actually limiting. We can do all kinds of things through our strengths, but there's some limit to them, and then our weaknesses kick in, right? Our liabilities, the things we struggle with, they inevitably kick in. So we're limited. Whereas if we're experiencing God's presence in our lives, it could be that that union with God, that empowerment of God, makes all things possible. So much more is possible if we were to embrace our weaknesses rather than running from them, rather than hiding from them. Jesus, as I mentioned, I think was talking about the same thing when in Matthew's gospel he says, truly, I tell you, it is hard for someone who is rich to enter the kingdom of heaven. Again, I tell you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for someone who is rich to enter the kingdom of God. When the disciples heard this, they were greatly astonished and asked, who then can be saved? Jesus looked at them and said, with man, this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible. And Jesus has had this interaction with a very rich person who wants to follow Jesus. And Jesus says, well, give away all your money. And he won't do it. He's holding on to his strength. Money and material possessions are often an indication, a representation of strength, right? We've been successful. And they also can make us feel strong. They make us feel secure and comfortable and all that kind of thing. Here, Jesus is saying, okay, yeah, if you lean on those strengths, you might actually miss out on the divine presence, the kingdom of God, the what life is really all about. And if you can let go of those strengths and actually embrace weakness, embrace vulnerability, then anything's possible. Anything is possible. I think Jesus was alluding to this when he shared with his disciples in John's gospel. Believe me when I say that I am in the Father and the Father is in me. Okay, this union with God. Or at least believe on the evidence of the works themselves. Very truly, I tell you, whoever believes in me will do the works I have been doing, and they will do even greater things than these because I am going to the Father. Jesus seems to be alluding to the fact that power comes from union with God. Power, real power. Power to change, power to be change, power to change the world, power to change everything around us. Power to bring about the impossible is possible when we experience union with God. And union with God comes through weakness. Ironically, it doesn't come through our strengths. So if we're feeling weak, if we're feeling vulnerable, if we're feeling frail, if we're feeling like a loser, if we're feeling pathetic, the story of Moses is saying to us, take heart, take courage. It's through people like us. And think about it collectively, the Hebrew people, the oppressed people, the people who didn't have power. People like us, the small people, can bring about change. We can be changed. We can be strong in this whole kind of way and lead lives that can be transformative. Lives that not only transform result in transformation of ourselves, but transformation of the world around us. I think we all know we so desperately need that. I wanted to talk about a couple of words that I think help sum this up. They're complicated words, I guess, because they're Greek words. But there's this term kenosis, which means emptying of oneself. We could think about that perhaps as surrendering our lives, letting go of clinging to our strengths, letting go of clinging to defensiveness and protectiveness and comfort, and embracing weakness and embracing vulnerability. It's a term that was used of Jesus when it talks in Philippians about Jesus emptying himself. And then there's this term theosis, which means union with God. It's kind of like we engage with the divine presence and we are empowered. So there's this sort of letting go of something and receiving something. This idea of kenosis, I think, that we have to be careful with, because this isn't saying as human beings we are completely useless and we just need to sort of deny our identity and then sort of and become almost like robots that are then God is sort of channeling God's self through, and we just walk around, you know, just doing stuff almost like robots. I don't think that's what this means. What this means, I think, is partnership with God, right? It's theosis is our spirit and the spirit of God coming into partnership and creating something beautiful, creating something that itself becomes creative, that it's something that it becomes something that has possibility about it. It has capacity. It has potential to accomplish something. And we live that out as empowered people. This, I think, sounds somewhat mystical, right? That mystical experience that Moses had, none of us have had a burning bush experience, I don't think. If you have, I'd love to hear about it afterwards. But we might use that metaphorically about times when we get enlightenment or an aha moment. But this sense of taking in God and letting go of, or at least embracing our own weakness and not seeing it as an enemy, but perhaps seeing it as a friend, can remain in the abstract. It can remain in a sort of place of mystery to us. But I actually think it's incredibly practical that every day, all day, we have all kinds of opportunities where we can do that. And I just want to run through a few of these now. There's several of them, and we're going to run through a list, and some of these will jump out at you, and some of them might be, that's not really relevant to me. But let's think if we were to seize opportunities to embrace our weakness in any given day. What about being yourself, right? I often struggle just to be myself because I'm afraid of what people think about me. But I can, rather than being afraid and holding myself, you know, putting on a mask, putting on that metaphorical mask or projecting something or trying to be somebody I'm not, what if I just let go of that and embraced the me as I am, with all its frailties, with all its struggles, with all its difficulties? How might my day be different if I lived in that kind of freedom? How might my actions be different if I lived in that kind of freedom? How might actually I be ironically stronger and more centered and more able to live life in a positive kind of way? What about being open? What if we were to share our vulnerabilities? Think of how often we've been helped by somebody else who's shared some of their own struggles. And it's encouraging to us, not just because we think like, oh, at least I'm not the only one, and that other person's lower down the pecking order than I thought they were, but we just feel a bond, we feel a connection, we feel hope. So sharing our vulnerabilities and our weaknesses actually brings about strength. It brings about courage, not only in the other person, but I think it does for us. When we share something and we're not rejected, and somebody else identifies back with us, that actually brings about a strength in us that we wouldn't have accomplished or wouldn't have experienced had we not disclosed that vulnerability. Saying sorry. When we say sorry, we're actually saying to the other person, it's vulnerable to say sorry, because we're saying to the other person, either you were right and I was wrong, or I hurt you and I'm sorry. It's kind of embracing our brokenness, it's embracing our weakness, but it can result in reconciliation, result in healing. I had a disagreement with My wife, a couple of weeks ago, we have more disagreements than every 2 weeks, just so you know, but this was a couple of weeks ago. It wasn't an argument. It was a very civil conversation, very good conversation. We had a disagreement about something, though, and I was trying to get her to agree with me. I wanted her to agree with me, my perspective. And but she wasn't going there. You know, again, it wasn't an unpleasant thing. But I didn't know if you've ever done this in a disagreement. I subtly introduced an element of guilt to try and it was very subtle. It wasn't sort of I wasn't using a baseball bat or anything like that. It was just trying to make her feel guilty, because I thought if she felt guilty, and I'm not necessarily thinking all this consciously, but it's like I'm using guilt to try and make her change her mind because I want her to agree with me. Has anybody ever done anything like that? Or I'm probably the, I'm just psychopath. Yeah, I get it. She still didn't agree with me. So I went away. That's how productive it is. So I went away and I was thinking about it more and realized, man, and this was very conscious now. I realized, oh, I just want her to agree with me because I feel insecure. And I won't tell you what it was about, but it was an issue that I felt really insecure about. And somehow I needed her to agree with me. And it was nothing to do with her, absolutely nothing to do with her. And I'd manipulated the situation out of my own insecurity. So my natural inclination was like, oh God, that's so embarrassing. I'm so useless and I want to recoil from it. But what I managed to do was to go back and say sorry. And that was, and it was, on the grand scale of things, it was a relatively minor thing, but it took, I didn't want to say sorry. I didn't want to own that because it makes you look weak. It makes you look like you're emotionally needy and I am. And I just accepted it and said sorry. And it resulted in some healing. And I've somehow felt stronger as a result of that. Not more in control or in charge or in whatever strength seems to represent in our culture, but somehow there was this inner strength, and somehow I experienced more union with God because I just let my guard down, and God meets us in that vulnerable space. Saying thank you, that's basically saying, I need you. I recognize what you did for me. Thank you so much for doing that. And I mean, under this one comes all kinds of things, like we need people. Perhaps one thing we need to do is ask for help or tell somebody that we need them. That can feel weak, right? I know there's certain things I'm doing. I want to do them myself. I want to be in control of them because somehow that makes me feel strong. It can feel needy to say to somebody, I need you. There's the irony. Or to ask for help. And we can recoil from that because it's a sense of weakness. And yet somehow, when we need one another and when we invite people in to help, we're stronger. We're much stronger because of the community, because of the help. We're stronger together than we are independent. Saying I love you or initiating love. So here's the three most important things you can say in the universe, I think, are saying sorry, saying thank you, and saying I love you. How difficult it is for us to initiate love. We respond to love, but to actually initiate love, to as we were talking about a few weeks ago, to adopt the attitude of a servant where we're initiating it. We're not looking for something in return, and we're not just responding to something that somebody has done for us, but it's like it starts with me. To say, to tell somebody how much they mean to you, to tell somebody how much you love them, to initiate affection. All these things are very risky business, right? Because we fear rejection, we fear getting used, and yet they're so powerful. Let's move on. We're going to race through these ones to wrap up. But risking failure. How often do we not do something because we don't want to blow it? You know, and we limit ourselves to our strengths. If I can do it and I know I can do it, and I've hopefully done it before and I've got a track record, then I'm in the game. But if we're asked to do something that we're not sure about, we tend to back off from that. And we don't face our enemies. We don't face things that intimidate us. And as a result, possibility becomes impossibility because we won't risk failure. Standing up to what's wrong. Think about standing up to injustice. When we think about the stand we're taking as followers of Jesus against injustice and unjust people, unjust systems, systems that we're part of standing up to our own injustice. It's intimidating. It feels like we're taking on this monster, something. How on earth can it all change? But could we be like those midwives and just say, no, we're not going to back down, even though the odds seem so much against us and so much against people who are standing up to powerful people. Engaging in conflict, we talked about this a little bit last week. Easiest thing to do in conflict is to run away because we don't want to lose. We don't want to be weak, but it's an opportunity for us to grow, an opportunity for us to be transformed. Let's not walk away from conflict. Being nonviolent is an act of weakness. The civil rights movement was deliberately chose a mode of love that inherently looked and made them weak. And yet in that was great power. In that was great strength. Just wrapping up here, letting go of control, situations we control, letting go of power. And think about everyday life here. We all have power in certain relationships, in our jobs, in certain roles we play in our lives. When we have power, it's very easy to maintain control. Perhaps there are some situations where we need to be giving away power and letting other people do the work that may not be exactly the way we want it to be, or it may make things, you know, upset the apple cart a little bit. But what if we just let go and let other people pick up some of the power, pick up some of the control, and give them an opportunity? What if we gave away credit? We're not bothered about who. I was there first. I did it. No, that was me. You know, all those things that, even if we don't say them, we feel them because we're just longing for people to give us credit because we feel so bad about ourselves. What if we just let all that stuff go? What if we resisted the urge to prove ourselves? In other words, what if we just said, I'm no longer going to judge myself based on my accomplishments. I'm going to evaluate myself based on the degree to which I've been able to let go, the degree to which I've been able to embrace my weakness and experience this union with God. I think this is what Jesus was getting at about the kingdom of God, this upside down kingdom. It's so mystical on one side, it's so tricky and difficult, and yet it's so practical. And as we come to communion now, communion is this time when we remember Jesus' death. And Paul, that leader we were talking about earlier, said, the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but it's wisdom to those who are being saved. In other words, it does not make any sense for Jesus to have just been this nonviolent, loving, serving person that eventually got crucified at one level. And yet I think if we think about this idea of embracing weakness, it's the ultimate embrace of weakness through which incredible strength, incredible healing, incredible power has come and in which we can participate ourselves. So as we take the bread and the wine, we've got crackers, gluten-free crackers, we've got juice, which are all at the back of the room there. And everybody is welcome to come, go to the back, take some of that, a cup, take a cracker. You can come back to your chair and eat it and drink it. As you do so, reflect, not just on that list, I've put up there, but just take that as like, there's so many opportunities in which we could let go and embrace the divine presence, embrace the God who is being itself. And where are we particularly challenged? Where are we feeling particularly weak? And see that as an opportunity for us. So we've got this moment of communion. There's places you can write out a prayer under journey and grow. It might just be your own prayer that you want to say and write out, or it might be a specific request you have and people will pray for you during the week. We've got places at the side here where you can make a financial offering. You can light a candle at the back. This is just a moment for us to pause and reflect and to surrender and receive God's presence to us. So I'm going to pray and then we'll take communion. Lord, thank you that in our weakness, you are with us. Because the reality is, I think most of us in this room right now feel pretty weak. We have our strengths, but we have our weaknesses. And thank you that you don't reject us, but ironically, you see those as ways for us to experience you more, that you love us all the more. So I pray in this moment for each of us, wherever we're at, Lord, you know, the multiple situations that each of our lives represent, and they're so different for all of us. Come to us, we pray. Let us experience union with you, closeness, intimacy with you. We ask that in your name. Amen.